Have you ever wondered what happened to the legendary Chuck Norris? We recently saw a video he made and it was shocking. He's in his 80s and still kicking butt, working out, staying active, and even has plenty of energy left over for his grandkids. He did this by just making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife tried too, and she says she feels 10 years younger. Her body looks leaner and she has energy all day. With the stress of everyday life, on top of the toll all the world's terrible news takes on us, it's more important than ever to stay healthy. My Morning Kick is the way to do it. Chuck made a video that explains everything. Make sure you watch it by going to mymorningkick.com/useful. It'll change the way you think about your health. Once again, that's mymorningkick.com/useful. You won't believe how simple it is.
Hi, my name is Peter, and I'm a prophet in the new novel, American Prophet. I prophesied a natural disaster, a pandemic, and that crazy election. Now there are conspiracies about me. A dude is shooting at me, and the president is threatening me. My story is on Amazon, Audible, and Apple Books. Check it out. Just look for American Prophet by Jeff Fulmer. That's American Prophet by Jeff Fulmer.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matte. Hey, everybody. Thank you for tuning in and joining us for another depressing week. Got to be honest with you. It's just a tough time to be
a human.
A human. It just is.
With empathy.
It just is. Yeah, it'd be so much easier to be a ghoul who is indifferent or even supports horrible things.
Right.
Because for anyone who doesn't, it's just a hard time. We're going to do our best to laugh a little at all the insanity in this world. It's a way to cope with it. And we're glad you're here with us. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. You can go there to support the show and get bonus content.
Yes, indeed.
And special offer alert. We are, for a limited time, offering a 30% discount for yearly subscriptions to this humble show, Useful Idiots. But you have to act fast. The first 50 people who click on the link in the description will get our special offer of 30% off for a year subscription, but do it quickly because these things will fly off the digital shelves. So check the link in the description.
Well, should we start with the four basic food groups? Democrats suck, Republicans suck. Isn't that weird? Isn't that terrible?
Let's do it. What do we have for Democrats suck?
As people probably know, the State Department recently admitted in a report that Israel has likely used U.S. supplied weapons in violation of humanitarian law. Then we saw Israeli forces attack a United Nations car in Rafah, killing an Indian worker. And now Biden's response to all of that is to go ahead and send $1 billion more dollars of weapons to Israel. That's the way the Biden administration handles what's happening in Israel, after its own State Department says that it's likely violating international human rights law. They said if they didn't have a credible Rafah plan, they would stop funding, and they haven't done that either.
And there it is from the Wall Street Journal. President Biden moving forward on a $1 billion weapons package for Israel, less than a week after pausing a shipment of bombs over Israel's planned assault on Rafah. It just shows what a complete farce the Biden line is, that he's holding Israel to account, that he's frustrated with Israel, he's angry at Israel. There have been all these leaks for months now from anonymous White House officials about how mad Biden is. When meanwhile, every time he has to actually do something, he continues the policy of arming Israel, except for that one pause on some weapons, which the Biden administration quietly undermined by admitting that the pause was temporary and that they might even send that pause shipment ultimately, and B, that the pause was basically immaterial. It was irrelevant because Israel already has all the weapons it needs to attack Rafah. And Biden just basically continued that by approving another $1 billion to Israel in weapons, because why not?
I also want to show a related exchange between journalist Niall Stanage and Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, where Jake Sullivan is being asked about whether or not Israel is restricting the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. So let's take a look at this.
Just to put a little bit of a point on Nadia's question, is Israel restricting the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza, or is it not?
So first, I would point you to the findings of the State Department report that just came out over the weekend. We believe that there were periods over the last few weeks where there were restrictions that had to be worked through. But at the time we put that report forward, we felt that there was sufficient work being done by the Israeli government with respect to the facilitation of humanitarian aid, that we did not make a judgment that anything had to be done in terms of U.S. assistance. That continues to be our position today.
Which they're restricting it, but it's okay in the way that they're restricting it.
Those are your words. They are certainly not my words. I'm not sure if that's how you ask questions, but yeah, go ahead.
I think he was just trying to clarify. That wasn't a gotcha. He asked a question. The answer was very opaque. And then Steinage tried to unpack it and translate it into simple English. And then Jake Sullivan got offended.
I mean, the answer is such a deceptive word salad. He's like, okay, fine. There were times in the last few weeks, like he omits like this like a more than 6 months long mass murder campaign in which Israel's blocked aid multiple times. But he's like, yeah, there are times in the last few weeks when Israel has not fully lived up to its obligations, but then we got assurances that, you know what, they're taking sufficient effort to remedy that. So nothing to see here. Let the weapons flow. Even though, of course, Israel is restricting aid as they've done, as they promised to do from the start, from the top. The Israeli government said, we're not going to let anything into Gaza. And that's exactly what they've done. And just to make sure that they follow through on that, they've let these mobs, you know, settlers and other Israelis go and block aid. And even there's a video recently of Israeli settlers, like, you know, destroying aid
from
trucks. It's, you know, and Jake Sullivan gets up there and says, yeah, they're taking sufficient steps, so we can keep sending them weapons.
Maybe they weren't before, but now they are.
And it's just so funny when he gets indignant. Someone trying to clarify his crazy word salad. He's like, how dare you try to
put words in my mouth? I don't know if that's how you ask a question, like lecturing this guy on what the polite. Well, that's the thing, is these people are like to weaponize civility so that they can hide their genocide behind civility. You're not supposed to be rude. Not that the reporter was being rude, but any attempt to get at the truth is considered rude by these ghouls.
Yeah.
Improper, exactly. Bad etiquette, a faux pas.
Well, let's turn to Republicans suck. And from an opposition party in government, you know, we generally expect them to hold the government to account, have a different position, to say, hey, let's not arm a mass murdering state and let it block humanitarian supplies to the besieged death camp that it's destroying. Republicans, though, their only critique is that we're not letting Israel destroy Gaza enough. And they're particularly indignant because Joe Biden recently paused a shipment of 2,000-pound bombs for Israel. And Senator Mike Lee of Utah was so angry about this that he accused Biden of re-victimizing Israel.
And Maria, this is just reprehensible. You're taking a group of people who have been victimized. Remember that there were thousands of people killed innocently, innocent people who were killed in Israel, men, women, children, even babies. And they're the victims. Now they're being re-victimized by, of all people, the United States of America. Congress, moreover, has recently passed an aid package I voted against because, among other things, it spent too much on other countries. And because I was concerned that the aid wouldn't actually make it to Israel. Well, lo and behold, a lot of it's not going to Israel, or at least it's being conditioned on Israel not being able to defend itself. This is inexcusable. And I really don't know how Joe Biden can survive this. I think this is yet another indication that it's time for change at the White House.
Wow.
Okay, so according to Mike Lee, if you withhold, pause some 2,000-pound bombs that flatten entire neighborhoods and kill countless people, bury more people under rubble. So basically, if you don't help create more victims, then you're re-victimizing Israel.
Right. You have to victimize, in order to avoid re-victimizing Israel, you must victimize Palestinians.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what he's saying. That is the America First Republican opposition right now. That if you're not helping Israel create victims, then you're victimizing Israel. What can you say about that? Like, what can you say with like with these people? And this is the entire Republican Party now. There's maybe a couple of exceptions, someone like Thomas Massie in the House. Right. But pretty much everybody else is in lockstep with this. What comes out of them is just, it's like the Biden camp, they have this word salad to pretend as if they're humanitarian, right? They care about the people of Gaza. The Republicans just don't hide that they don't. That's our political spectrum.
It's nice to see the range of suckage. So for my Isn't That Weird, this is a story that's kind of like between and Isn't That Weird and Isn't That Terrible. Here is allegedly a cute little panda held in a zoo in China. Aaron, what do you think that is? Are you convinced?
That's a panda?
Yeah.
I could see that being a dog.
All right, you saw through it. So you would not perhaps have been fooled. But yes, this story is about an outrageous deception where a panda exhibit was actually nothing more than an exhibit of dogs dyed black and white. Let's take a look at this video. Now, those are really absolutely adorable dogs. And I feel like maybe with my parents' dog, I don't know if she could get away with it, but Bodhi could look pretty cute in that black and white dye. But it is, that would be species appropriation, I think, because these are dogs. And this zoo in China said that they had no panda bears at the zoo, so they wanted to do this. And I'm going to read part of this New York Post article. Just they always have great lines. And this one is, many visitors accuse the sanctuary of animal cruelty. However, zoo officials insist that the dog fishing scheme isn't harmful to animals.
Well, this wasn't hard for me to figure out that dogs were involved, because I just, if I see a small animal, it's furry, somewhat approximate to a dog. Katie, because it's your, you know, if it's your story, I know it's going to be about a dog because you love.
Oh, I see. Right. Dog. True. Yeah.
So, you know.
Oh, right. So if like someone else had presented it, you wouldn't have been so quick to.
Yeah, I possibly could have been duped. I possibly
could have been duped. Right.
Here I put my sleuthing skills together. Right. And my investigative journalism skills.
There you go. Really,
this is what I'm in it for. And I'm so proud of myself for figuring it out. That really is about cute dogs. But ultimately, this seems like a victimless crime.
It does.
Everyone got to see some cute dogs. It's an interesting look. Have them dressed up, have them look like pandas. Maybe a panda would not want to be in that zoo. Maybe a dog doesn't mind as much as a panda.
That's true, yeah. I mean, you don't want to give the dog a kind of identity complex, right? They may wind up feeling like they're inadequate as dogs, and they have to pretend to be pandas. They have to panda present. That's, I think, the only potential downside.
In my experience, dogs are a very giving.
That's true.
Creature, you know, they aim to serve others. I mean, I haven't met too many selfish dogs.
Right, unlike cats, who are by cats, nature selfish. Right.
Exactly. So, you know, I'm going to assume on behalf of the small dog species here that they just didn't mind. Yeah.
Yeah. They probably were happy. They probably, the only thing that would make them sad is if they didn't pull it off. So they probably would want people to believe they're pandas. I think you're right. So it's a heartwarming, it's kind of a bittersweet. Isn't that weird? Isn't that bittersweet, but adorable?
Okay. Well, speaking of pretending to be someone or something that you're not, Antony Blinken, whose job is supposed to be a diplomat, he recently touched down in Ukraine for a surprise visit. And, you know, his job is supposed to be a diplomat, but he spends all his time warmongering in Ukraine, warmongering in Israel as it mercilessly attacks Gaza. And you get the sense from Antony Blinken, he just always looks so uncomfortable. He looks a little shook. He looks scared that he's not comfortable in his own skin, which is understandable because his entire life is a lie. But sometimes he gives us a flash of what he really wants to be, and that is a rock musician. He has these songs on Spotify under his own name that are, you should listen to them if you haven't heard them yet. You know, I have my own opinion about them, but everyone's got different tastes, so maybe someone out there would like them. But Antony Blinken loves to jam, and while in Ukraine, even though Ukraine is suffering a massive catastrophe as Russian forces advance as they're running out of young people to sacrifice, they've recently lowered the age of conscription to 25 from 27 because there's just not enough people left to fight because so many have died in this proxy war that Blinken has prolonged rather than ending through diplomacy. So Blinken touched down in Kyiv and he offered Ukraine, well, he offered them this. Let's take a look.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yes, Ukraine's been used by the Biden administration to weaken Russia. That's been the Biden administration's open goal. So they've acknowledged to using Ukraine for their goal of undermining a geopolitical rival, not actually safeguarding Ukraine's well-being. And yes, Biden has prolonged this war by rejecting multiple diplomatic opportunities, as we've covered extensively on this show. But Ukraine does get treated to a rendition of Antony Blinken.
Right.
Thing along with Neil Young's Rockin' in the Free World.
Yeah, two things I'd like to add about that. One is that isn't it great that C-SPAN happened to be set up there to capture it? And the other thing is that, you know, this Neil Young song is not a pro-USA song. It's kind of like, you know, Bruce Springsteen's song, Born in the USA. People who don't really understand, like, reading comprehension, they think it's a pro-USA song and it's not. It's an anti-war song. This song is very critical of the United States, both like foreign policy and domestic policy. And one of the verses says, we got 1,000 points of light for the homeless man. We got a kinder, gentler machine gun hand. We've got department stores and toilet paper. Got styrofoam boxes for the ozone layer. Got a man of the people says, keep hope alive. Got fuel to burn. Got roads to drive.
You know, so this song came out in 1989, I believe.
Yeah,
it's a very Cold War era reference. Yeah. So, you know, the 1,000 points of light, that's a reference to George H.W. Bush talking about the U.S., you know, having 1,000 points of light and being like the light onto nations, being the leader of the free world. Right. And then he talks and he says, we have a man of the people saying, keep hope alive.
Jesse.
You know who that is? That's Jesse Jackson.
Right.
Who back then was running for president and actually was an authentic man of the people, which we're in short supply of these days. So, yes, Neil Young was criticizing the very kind of militarism and triumphalism that Antony Blinken now embodies, but he's so clueless and so just like out to lunch. He doesn't understand any of that.
Right.
You can see it in his body language. Like,
I know
he looks so uncomfortable in everything he does because, you know, he knows somewhere deep down that everything he does is a lie and everything is in the service of really horrible things, but really who he wants to be is just a musician, you know? And I bet if he wasn't such a warmonger, he'd actually be a more comfortable musician on stage.
Right.
You know,
it's true.
That would be my lesson. If I was his guitar teacher, that'd be my lesson to him. It's like, Tony, you know, work on your scales, but also stop destroying the world.
Right. Yeah. Work on your scales and also on diplomacy. So there's less blood on your hands because it is hard to play the guitar well when you have blood on your hands.
There you go.
Makes it much more challenging.
That's a great guitar tip. That's a very good guitar tip. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, somebody did a cover of Tony Blinken's cover of Rocket in the Free World. And this is what they came up with. And that comes via at Work Week Normies on Twitter, at Work Week Normies. And very well done. I love a good parody. I love a good parody of a real life parody in the form of Blinken playing along with that song.
Also, I just want to give Blinken some credit. He has gotten some backlash for this because Ukrainians who want more funding for the proxy war are mad at him for performing this. People like us, obviously, are mad at him for different reasons, Aaron, for performing this. But you know who isn't mad at him was the guitarist who shared the stage with him, who said, he was connecting with eyes with our band leader, with me. It was our first performance on stage, but it feels like we were a band for 2 years. So the guitarist in that band that was performing really felt a connection.
It was very touching. Yeah. It was very touching. Again, could there be other ways for Tony Blinken to connect with Ukrainians?
That's a good question.
Other than using them and using their people as cannon fodder in a proxy war against against Russia? I think there are.
Maybe.
Just like
perhaps
when Tony Blinken brags about how many jobs he's creating by funneling tens of billions of more taxpayer dollars into the military industrial complex, are there other ways he could maybe think about creating jobs in the U.S. than just replenishing weapons stockpiles for the Pentagon?
Yeah,
it's just so sad. It really is. It
Aaron,
really
he's
is.
Thinking outside the box. He's a maverick diplomat. Yeah. We are so excited to be bringing on to the show Susan Abulhawa, who is a Palestinian-American writer and human rights activist. She's the author of Mornings in Jenin, which is a great book, by the way. I highly recommend it, which was translated into 32 languages and sold more than a million copies. She's also the author of The Blue Between Sky and Water and Against the Loveless World. And she is the founder of Playgrounds for Palestine and the executive director of Palestine Rights, which is a great Palestine literary festival.
And she's been to Gaza twice since October 7th and has a really harrowing experience to share, but that is really hard to listen to, but really important to listen to.
Yeah.
And so we talked to her about that in this interview and a lot more.
Susan Abulhawa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Katie. It's good to be here.
So can you just tell us about how many times you've been to Gaza and when your latest trip was and what you saw?
So since October 7th, I was there twice. I think we talked after the first time I went in. And then things deteriorated since then, and they were much worse when I went in the second time. Even though the second time I went in, there was a bit more supplies, the more aid had gotten in. So food was a little bit more available, even though the WCK or World Central Kitchen had ceased operations. But overall conditions were much worse. And right now, since Israel physically entered Rafah, you know, the messages I'm getting are just hard to hear. People are just really, really bewildered. Like, they don't know where to go. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere safe, first of all. And there's no place that has any infrastructure. Like, there's no infrastructure for water and food. Like, you know, it's the two main essentials. It's also really, really hot in Gaza right now. So the tents are like ovens. I mean, you walk in to the tents and there's just a marked, I mean, you can feel the increase in temperature right away. The hot weather has also brought out all manner of insects, and, you know, people are on the beach. And so there's a lot of mosquitoes and flies and, you know, just general lack of sanitation, lack of supplies, lack of anything. And it's just really, it's all so degrading and desperate and dark. But also, there's still, you know, humanity still exists, and people are finding ways to care for their children. They're finding ways to hold like classes for some students. They're trying to live. It's quite remarkable and humbling to see that. But you know, the full gamut of the most raw human expressions are are apparent and evident.
And we actually have video of you outside of Nasser Hospital, which we're going to play. Is there anything you want to say about it to set it up before we play it?
I had been there previously when some of the bodies were being pulled. I didn't film anything. I went back the next day. And I think after that, they found another mass grave. But when I went, all of the bodies had been cleared out of at least two mass graves. Yeah, it was just trying to just show what I was seeing there and sort of describe the smell, which was horrible. And I just, you know, I think it kind of went viral because I couldn't help, you know, I teared up a little, but I wasn't crying. The, you know, Al Jazeera sort of was saying, you know, Susana Bulhoa cries. And but it was, you know, it's hard. I mean, I think any human being with an intact conscience and it, you know, you can't help but be moved to tears often there, even if it's just tears in private. So just the inhumanity is, it's hard to fathom, much less put into words, Katie. It just, you know, as Palestinians, we've seen a lot of death. We've seen a lot of pain, collective suffering, collective grief, collective longing, collective despair. But I really have never seen anything like this in Palestinian society or anywhere in the world. It is just, it is a constant state of terror. Like, if you can imagine, you know, 2.5 million people living with just constant sort of edge. Like, one thing that I noticed when I returned, like both times, and I was only, you know, I wasn't living the despair. I knew I could leave. I had brought in enough, you know, food, you know, protein bars that I could, you know, survive. And I was an observer. And both times when I left, when I would finally get back, I would just, or actually when I just got left, even when I was in Egypt, I just feel this overwhelming, powerful physical need to sleep. Like, I would fight to just stay awake. And then when I finally submitted, like both times, I just slept, you know, 12, 13 hours straight. So there's something, you know, it affects you on a physical level. And I'm saying this, you know, I was there both times temporarily and as an observer. And that's what happened to me physically. So you can imagine what people are experiencing who have no choice but to live this and who are trying to, who are feeling all of these emotions to try and protect their families, try and protect their children, trying to find a place to shelter, a place to just get some water, some food, just the most elemental human needs for survival are absent. And they have been consistently absent, coupled with, you know, consistent terror for 7 months without respite. That, you know, it destroys people. People, you know, you fall apart emotionally, psychologically, mentally, physically. It is really a blight on humanity. To all that we are allowing this.
Let's take a look at that video.
I'm at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, where NGOs have so far uncovered two mass graves since Israel withdrew their forces. Many of the bodies that were found here were those of healthcare workers who were still in their scrubs and patients with IV catheters still in their arms. Many were still bound with plastic cuffs. Were executed at point blank distance or buried alive. Really thank God for you guys Every place here is tinged with so much death and destruction, it beggars belief. What's being done here to life is just difficult to fathom, and it's really impossible to contain in language or even in video. This is a Holocaust. It's an extermination of an indigenous people. I'm gonna let you just have a look at the views here. This was a hospital. San Yunus is completely destroyed, by the way. The city, their tents have been turned into ovens. The heat is unbearable, truly. And now there's flies and mosquitoes and scorpions that people have to contend with. I mean, these are the details that don't reach people. Honestly, I think most people are just waiting for death, to be honest. They're hanging on because of their children. They're hanging on because of the people that they love. I mean, it is really, really... You can see... These are the zip ties that were found on bodies. You can see this obviously belonged to a small person, a child. This is you can see this is also was on a child. And even though all the bodies have been removed, at least the ones that they found, but there's still a really horrible smell.
I had been in Khan Yunis the day before or 2 days before, I can't remember now. It was a place that, I remember with fondness, that was full of life and people, and the destruction is total. There's not a single building anywhere in Khan Yunis that isn't partially or completely destroyed, which, gives a lie to Israel's claim that they're targeting Hamas. By their own admission, they estimated 30,000 to 40,000 fighters, and yet they've destroyed at least, I don't know, I think it's like a million buildings or something like that. How does that compute? If you're targeting Hamas, how the math doesn't add up. Right. They're destroying what, like 10,000 buildings per one person. Very clearly their aim is to destroy life, is to destroy people's homes, to destroy their ability to return and rebuild. And I think people in the United States are generally anesthetized or they never really connected with humanity abroad, unless it's in Europe, like Ukraine or something. And so there is this idea that it's racist at its core, but they don't put themselves, like, they can't imagine what it's like to for us to, spend your whole life saving up to build a house, and then you finally do, and you retire and you're with your wife and you're surrounded by your kids and your grandkids, and then suddenly it's gone in an instant, and your children are gone, your grandchildren are gone, and you're with your wife with maybe two remaining grandchildren, and you're in a tent. There's this, I feel like in the United States, people think, well, that's just how brown people live over there, and they just sort of, oh, that's too bad. And they move on. But there's not a human identification with this suffering in the United States. And so that's just my observation, particularly juxtaposed to the way that ordinary people reacted to Ukrainians losing their homes.
And who are the people that you thank in the video? You say, thank God for you?
For the students. I said, thank God for the students. Yeah, I mean, it was, so I talked to a lot of people. So, when this was first happening, a lot of the folks that I talked to didn't really comprehend the magnitude of it. And it was only later that like one of my friends, I was telling her about it and she was kind of rolling her eyes. And then a few days later, she was like, I didn't realize it was this big, you know, it's this meaningful. But generally people don't know. I mean, the internet is cut off and there's only like a few points where you can get internet, and it's only certain, you know, like for example, the building where all the UN staff, there's internet there, but it's also very weak. There's a few points around the hospitals where people, you know, IT folks have been able to rig up internet, and there's independent, you know, also IT people who rig up some sort of connectivity and they sell like temporary passcodes for an hour of internet, things like that. So generally, and when people do connect, I mean, the most they can do is, you know, exchange WhatsApp messages. You can't really open up websites and read news and, or, you know, except for just a few places, you know, and just like literally maybe like less than a dozen places in the whole area. So people don't know what's going on in the world. They just feel abandoned. They feel alone. And that's it. They feel forsaken. Nobody's, you know, they can't get aid in. The airdrop aid is so demeaning and lethal, and not to mention inadequate. But, you know, whenever I was telling them, I tried to explain to people that I met that, you know, people around the world are in solidarity with you, and they see what's going on, and they're fighting. It surprises them, and it does lift their mood, actually.
It seems like there's a split, right? Because you talked about people's failure in the United States to see the humanity of people when they're not Ukrainian, let's say. But then you do have people who really are moved by what's happening in Palestine.
Yes, absolutely. But I think there's still not the masses that,
right, yeah,
that were immediately moved by Ukraine.
And certainly not the politicians.
They're pointless.
Right.
They should be irrelevant. We have to claim power back from these people that we've allowed to create this cruel, unnatural, exploitive order that we're forced to live under and participate in. You know, this is kind of a moment of truth for humanity, because if we allow this not only to continue, but to continue without any accountability, without any serious consequences and serious changes in the world, then there will be no more limits for what these fascists will do. That's really terrifying. And it won't stop. It won't stop with Gaza.
Susan, half the population of Gaza are children. I'm just wondering how, like, visually you experience that when you visit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what you used to, I want to start by telling you what it used to look like, what children used to look like in Gaza. They were always in their little uniforms, tidy hair, you know, everything in place, and pigtails and clean uniforms. And you really, there would be, you know, really, really poor children occasionally, but mostly even poor people like sort of took care of themselves and their children and how, and their parents. You never really saw the filth, the sense of destitution, the aimlessness, the depression in small people. I mean, but it's really palpable now. I mean, I had kids tell me that, you know, like I asked this one kid, like what I was interviewing a lot of children, and asked this one kid, you know, what he wants. Most children were saying, we want to go home. We want to go to our school. We want, you know, and this kid said, I want to die. I want to be with my dad. I want to die. And he was adamant about it. And he said, he was maybe 8 or something. And I think those feelings are prevalent among a lot of children. There are children who've lost their parents and all the elders in their family, and they're forced to care for each other. I mean, there are situations where you have, 10-year-old taking care of her infant siblings and toddler siblings, and same thing for young boys. There's a lot of there's also something that isn't really talked about much, but there are reports about this. I mean, children are being trafficked. There's a lot of missing kids who aren't missing necessarily under the rubble. There was like one report, there was one news item a while ago about, the one Israeli who stole a baby. You probably remember that, Katie. But there's a lot more of that. Kids are, you find them just barefoot. They're dirty. They clearly haven't been able to bathe in, at least weeks, if not months. They're having to fetch water every day instead of go to school or sell things on the side of the road just to make a few shekels. I don't know. I mean, I'm sorry to be, not to have better news. I want to have better news. I want to say better things, but it's just really bad. That said, though, I mean, people are in a lot of pain, but they're not broken. People in Gaza have a lot of deep faith. And I feel like Islam has been a really, really powerful anchor that's holding the society together and keeping it steady. Some of my friends, on the one hand, would express their despair and cry. And on the other hand, they would just say Alhamdulillah, which is, expressing gratitude to God. And it's the Muslim sort of submission to God's will. Like, God knows better. And it's just acknowledging God's wisdom and their role to endure and, have faith that things will be better. So there's that. And there's also this incredible humanity. Like I have like a whole box full of like little small gifts and things that people who really have nothing figured out, how to give me something, how to gift me something, before I left. It's just, it's really humbling and it's beautiful. But nobody should have to endure this. Nobody should have to endure what Palestinians in Gaza and also in the West Bank are enduring at this hour. It's monstrous.
You're also an animal lover, and we have a clip of you visiting Sulala Animal Rescue in Gaza. You brought a cat that you rescued. Let's take a look at this, and then you can tell us about the cat backstory. What? So what animal are those, by the way?
Those are donkeys.
They're donkeys. Okay, yeah. So tell us what happened here.
There's a horse in there as well. So that little white cat was staying. So one of my friends had was taking refuge in a home with some of her colleagues and relatives in Mawasi Rafah. And 100 people were living in this house, and it had like a little courtyard, and there was a cat that had been left. It was obviously a house cat. It belonged to somebody. It wasn't doing well. Like the other, it was getting beat up by the other street cats. And they tried to feed it, but they're overwhelmed with life in general. And I suggested I take her to the rescue, and they were happy about that. It was, people like my friend couldn't just abandon her, but at the same time, it was another mouth to feed. It was another thing to worry about. So I took that off of her plate and found her a place to get some care, and she got vet care. She got some food, and actually it's a he, it's a male.
And what were they saying in Arabic? Some of the things that they were saying.
Oh, so we were actually discussing another, like that. That's the man you hear is Abu Sa'id, Sa'id al-Ilar. He started Sulala, and we were talking about like a program in the future to help some of the donkeys who are really the horses who are bearing a lot of the brunt of this, because there's no or very little fuel, so cars don't really operate much. What fuel is available is extremely expensive, and so donkeys and horses have become the main mode of transportation. And as you can imagine, they're overworked. They're not fed well because the people themselves don't have food. They're not watered well because people don't have water. And, you know, so that's, we were talking about that, and just, that was something he wants to do. And we were talking about that, and it's, you know, I feel like people might, and they do criticize me for caring about the animals at this hour. But I think liberation is the liberation of all life, and animals are nations unto themselves, and they deserve, they also deserve to be free and protected. And Israeli bombs have spared nothing. They have spared no human, no animal, no tree, no river, no home, no patch of grass, no cemetery.
And there are also these really moving videos of Palestinians and Palestinian children going back into their homes, rescuing animals.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. And you see a lot of the rescuers too. The civil defense pulling cats and dogs out from under the rubble and donkeys. That's also one of the powers of Islam. I mean, it's mercy is a pillar of Islam. A lot of people don't know this, but the whole idea of mercy and kindness to animals was a Muslim sort of concept. And that's where the concept of halal emerged from, halal is based on the idea of no animal suffering whatsoever before, if they're eaten, and they cannot see death coming. They can't. And there's all kinds of rules around, you know, the concept of halal that's predicated on kindness and inclusion of animals in life. So,
and what are your thoughts on the 2024 election? You've written very forcefully about the need to defeat Biden. And I want to ask you the question that I'm sure you always get, which is, won't Trump be worse?
I don't care. I also don't know what's worse than what Biden is doing. I mean, what can possibly be worse than genocide? I mean, what is worse than besieging 2.5 million people in a tiny, densely populated place and then bombing the hell out of them and watching for 7 months, watching a live streamed genocide? What is worse than that? And then sending billions upon billions upon billions every month. More and more billions are going to this monstrosity to continue this genocide. What could possibly be worse? Maybe there is worse, but I think what's worse than Trump is for the American people to go to the ballot box and vote for somebody who did this in broad daylight and say, this is okay. We will always fall into line as long as you give us a choice between two war criminals and we have to decide which one is worse than the other. That's worse. The message that it sends to the Democratic Party and to the ruling class is far worse than the personalities that are going to come into power. I think our energy really needs to be focused on mass mobilization. And when it comes to electoral politics, at the very least, we have to teach them a lesson that no, genocide is not okay. And we're not going to fall into line. We have to have a red line. It's that simple. And that's what I mean when I say, I don't care who the alternative is, because the more important thing is to make our red line very clear and not give them our acquiescence, not give them our whatever it is they want from us. Like, do you remember when Hillary, I think the last time we talked, you even played that clip of Hillary where she said, you know, tough.
Get over yourself. People over who don't want to vote for Biden need to get over themselves. Yeah.
Right. And it's like that's how they think. And that's what they think we're going to do. And that's what they're counting on. They're counting on people to just say, oh, well, this is the only choice we have. What are we going to do? Trump's worse. So let's just vote for this guy who conducted a genocide in full view of the whole world and funded it with billions of our tax dollars that we desperately need at home because we don't have adequate health care. We have crappy education. We don't have services. We have no investment in the arts. We have crappy infrastructure. We have a massive wealth gap, an embarrassing minimum wage. And we have to watch as billions of dollars are going to fund this Zionist entity. So no, that's not okay. And no, none of us should vote for that. None of us should be okay with that, no matter what the alternative is.
Susan, I want to ask you about the issue of Ukraine, Palestine, and the left. When it comes to, you know, the left, there's pretty much a broad consensus about supporting Palestinian rights, opposing Israel. There's not really a split there anymore. When it comes to Ukraine, there is. And there are people on the left who think that it's morally consistent to support the Palestinian fight for freedom, while meanwhile basically taking the NATO state line when it comes to Ukraine. Even though everyone from Joe Biden to Mitch McConnell says that supporting Israel's mass murder campaign in Gaza is the same as supporting the fight against Russia and Ukraine and flooding Ukraine with weapons. And that's why Biden's $95 billion Senate package bundled both money for Israel's mass murder campaign and the Ukraine proxy war. Now, you have come under fire for your position on Ukraine. You were supposed to speak at a festival about a year ago, but because you were somewhat critical of the NATO proxy war in Ukraine, there was an effort to cancel you. So I'm just wondering, your thoughts on this issue of people trying to draw a link between the two struggles in Ukraine and in Gaza and your own experience with this.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Aaron, you said in the intro that some of Susan's stories were harrowing, and that's true. They are harrowing. The stories, some of the videos, but it's also so important for us to not lose touch and not become desensitized about what's happening in Gaza, in Palestine, with our government's approval and our tax dollars.
You know, it's very hard to listen to the accounts from Gaza like Susan's, but the alternative is not knowing, right? So people have to ask themselves, would you rather know or not know? And as hard as it is for those of us who are not there just to witness all this and feel powerless, the alternative is not knowing. And I think it's always worth it to know rather than to not know.
Yeah. And make sure you become members of the show if you're not already a subscriber at usefulidiotspodcast.com, because you'll get Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness, and extended interviews. And we, in this extended interview with Susan, talk a little bit about academic censorship, the policing of pro-Palestine speech, or even just Palestinian speech in general, and also how she was canceled over some interesting comments she made about Zelensky.
If you criticize our holy proxy war, then you can be canceled. It's not just about, obviously the top way to be canceled right now is to criticize our holy client state in Israel.
Right.
I mean, that's a guaranteed cancellation. But, a second place I'd say has come from being critical of the Ukraine proxy war and maybe advocating, instead of war and spending on war, some peace. And that happened to Susan, and we talk all about it.
Yeah. And that's, again, at usefulidiotspodcast.com. See you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.